Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Hey everybody, we got a great one today. You know, for a change, Catherine Rampell joins me again. Heretofore, Catherine was an op-ed columnist for the Washington Post, but left the Post and is now with the Bulwark and co-host of MSNBC's weekend primetime show. Catherine writes a lot about the economy, and we discuss the shutdown and tariffs. We touch on Epstein, but we recorded this on Wednesday, and a lot, of course, has happened since. The White House, of course, is in crisis. The Epstein emails are so damning, especially the one where Epstein writes that Trump knew what was going on. It was an email he wrote to himself that I don't think is getting enough attention. This from the Washington Post. Trump knew of it and came to my house many times during that period, Epstein wrote in an email to himself on February 1st, 2019, several months before he was arrested on sex trafficking and killed himself in jail. He never got a massage. So that's bad news for Trump. Trump knew of it. Is bad. He never got a massage is good for Trump. I think Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt kind of stepped in it. She said this.
Jeffrey Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago until President Trump kicked him out because Jeffrey Epstein was a pedophile and he was a creep.
Okay, if you knew the guy was a pedophile, he probably should have said something. You know, to the authorities. I mean, even if the guy was your best friend for 10 years, you really got to say something. It's a pretty desperate situation for Trump. Representative Adelita Grijalva was sworn in on Wednesday, and they got the final signature on the discharge petition to release the Epstein files. In a desperate move, the White House hauled Lauren Boebert, one of four Republicans who had signed the discharge petition, to the White House Situation Room to get her to take her name off the petition. They sat her down with Attorney General Bondi and FBI Director Patel. Now, the Situation Room is the most secure area in the White House. It's used to discuss national security issues. This is the most pressure you can put on a member of Congress. And to her credit, Boebert didn't fold. Boebert released a social media post on Wednesday afternoon that sort of taunted the White House. She wrote, I want to thank White House officials for meeting with me today. Together, we remain committed to ensuring transparency for the American people. So now Speaker Johnson is going to put it to a vote this coming week. The expectation is that there will be mass defections from Republicans and it will be passed overwhelmingly. Then it goes to the Senate. I think the White House believes the Senate will kill it, but I'm not so sure. Maybe enough Republican senators say, the American people have a right to know. And if the Senate passes it, Trump, of course, would veto it. That will not be popular with the American people, especially his MAGA base who wanted these files for quite some time. I think this cuts through partisan politics, and the American people will be virtually unanimous in wanting these files released. You need a two-thirds majority in both houses to override a presidential veto. Republicans will have to make a choice. In a related story, it's reported that Epstein's right hand, Ghislaine Maxwell, is receiving specialized concierge treatment in the Club Fed prison that she shouldn't be in, shouldn't be allowed in the first place. Maxwell's getting special meals brought to her dorm, a private room to work out in, and a computer to work on her petition to President Trump for commutation of her 20-year sentence with the help from the warden. She's also getting to play with a puppy, which is part of a service dog training program, which violates rules for sex offenders. But the puppy doesn't know that. Well, let's go to Catherine Rampell. It's a great one, you know, for a change. How old is your baby now?
A little over 3 months.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. And how was it? How was the delivery?
Oh, you know, just a breeze. Like, childbirth, like, whatever. I don't know why people talk about it as if it's unpleasant. It's done.
It's done. Well, congratulations. And so you left the Washington Post.
Correct.
And now you're with the Bulwark. You know, when I've done my interviews with you, what I would do is just read four of your columns and then ask you about them. And you've only written one Bulwark column.
I just started last week. So give me
some
time.
Is that when you started?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, so you wrote about the tariffs, and I'll ask you about that. And you're on, is it Weekend Prime Time?
Yes.
Is that what it's called?
Yes, the Weekend Prime Time. And
yeah.
You are welcome to come back anytime.
Oh, thank you.
We would love to have you back to talk about Minnesota politics or otherwise.
And that's on MSNBC for people who don't know.
Soon to be rebranded as MS Now, of course. I have to plug that because that's happening imminently.
Of course. You write mainly economic stories.
Yeah, I would say economics, broader public policy and politics.
Right. Okay. Well, we have some political stories of late, particularly the end of the shutdown, which is looming today. We're recording this on Wednesday, and I think they're meeting in the House now, and the shutdown will be done this evening.
I sure hope so.
Well, good. I'm glad you feel that way. Before I get to the shutdown, though, I have to ask you about the Epstein emails. He wrote one to Ghislaine Maxwell and a few to or Michael Wolff are the ones. I guess they released three of them, the Democrats on the committee. And one of which, Epstein writes that Trump spent a significant amount of time with a woman who was one of the victims. That's not good for Trump, is it?
Presumably not. Somehow he survives every other scandal that would not be survivable, but it certainly looks bad, given that again and again we've been told that Trump had nothing to do with Epstein's dirty deeds, wasn't aware of them. And if anything, if you get into like deep QAnon lore, Trump was maybe the guy who brought Epstein down, that he was undercover something. I think that there are all these weird conspiracy theories.
Wow, I have not heard that one.
Yeah, don't dig too deep into it on the interwebs. You'll be upset.
They're going to release the files, right, now because Grijalva is seated.
She's seated. I don't know enough about how the discharge petition process works, which is this. Maybe you know more about this from your days on the Hill. But it's not automatic. I believe that after she is seated, there's still some other steps that have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Johnson, for example, calls another recess immediately after they open the government, that could maybe short circuit those attempts to release the files. But I am not a parliamentary procedure expert. That is just my vague understanding, is that it's not like a done deal. Even if she is sworn in, there have to be some additional votes cast. And I think they have, they're on a timer for how quickly this discharge petition thing runs out. I don't know. I'm the wrong person to ask about all of that.
Right. Okay.
But there's definitely a pathway to getting the files released, but that doesn't mean that somebody who understands the procedures better than I do couldn't foreclose that pathway.
Okay. well, let's get to the shutdown. This was the longest in history. How many days? It was 43 days.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. What'd you make of the seven Democrats plus Angus King joining the 52 Republicans and this thing?
I understand why people are pissed off, because the question is, what did they really get in exchange for ultimately caving? And it doesn't really look like much. There is a promise for a future vote on health insurance, a vote that, even if it does happen, does not ensure that the bill would pass. And there's no obligation for the House
to take it.
Correct. And I would definitely not trust Mike Johnson, even if he gave his word, to have a vote. But he doesn't seem, based on what he said thus far, and again, it's Wednesday, maybe things will change by the time this comes out, it doesn't seem likely that he would give it a vote. He has said as much. So it's not really clear what it was all for. Now, the counter argument, I know, is they wanted to make more salient, they being the Democrats, wanted to make more salient the fact that the premium rate hikes were Republicans' fault. And I think that they did more or less achieve that.
Well, they had achieved that, I think, for the midterms. I think that was one of the reasons.
Right. So it's like, well, what did they get? I guess they got that. I think the timing of all of this is still a little perplexing. Like, why did they wait until 40 days? I think it was 40 days when the Senate vote happened.
I think they wanted to wait till after the election. Yeah. I really do, because this motivated Democrats. Democrats are mad that they did this.
Yep.
And I there is a counter argument, which is, were the Republicans ever going to cave? And I don't think they ever were.
Yeah, I think that's part of the issue. Well, there are two issues. One is that they may have never caved on the thing that was supposed to be the only demand, or the key demand the Democrats made, which is on health insurance.
Right.
If they had said, well, we would take enhanced premium tax credits, the health insurance thing, or, I don't know, something on Medicaid to something else on health insurance, or, you know, like a suite of possibilities. Maybe there would have been an off-ramp where Republicans could have made some concession. They didn't. They basically made it about one thing and one thing only.
Well, they made concessions in the final thing that it was agreed to, not to fire any of the...
Yeah, but why would they wouldn't have fired them in to begin with?
Trump would have.
Well, but not under the auspices of a shutdown. It's right. Like, so I don't know that that's really so much of a win. I think the other issue is that Trump was really willing to take hostages. And what I mean by that is take food stamps. This administration worked really, really hard to ensure maximum suffering, to ensure people stayed hungry.
Now, what do you think of that morally? I mean, in other words, could you believe it? I mean, could you believe that he did that?
Yes. I think there's been enough hostility towards SNAP, the food stamp program, within the Republican Party for decades that maybe there was a little bit of callousness to begin with about taking away food stamp benefits. And if you looked at the big, beautiful bill, whatever, big, beautiful act now that passed, that also cuts food stamp funding as well as other kinds of safety net programs.
I think part of the agreement the Democrats got on this, the eight Democrats got, was increased SNAP.
Well, it was like that they would extend funding for a longer period so that it would not be part of the hostage taking in theory when this continuing resolution runs out in January. So I think part of the backstory here is a lot of Republicans don't really like food stamps anyway, even though there are farmers and other red state constituencies that benefit from it. And red state residents, plenty of people who vote Republican receive food stamps.
Actually, I think that more people in red areas of states receive SNAP.
But beyond that, there's that existing hostility, and I think they realized that this was a real pain point, and Democrats were not going to be willing to allow that suffering to continue, right? Because Democrats were making the argument that they were shutting down the government to prevent people from suffering through loss of health insurance. It's maybe harder for them to maintain that position if by the very act of not voting to reopen the government, they are enabling an administration to incur more suffering, I should say, because people can't get their food assistance. And when I say that the administration went above and beyond to make sure people stayed hungry, I mean, they were really creative. So not only did they tell courts, please prevent us from being forced to give out food stamp funding, which they very much could have done. There was definitely funding that was available to them to do that. There was this contingency funding. They went to courts. They asked again and again, please block orders from lower courts saying we have to send this money out. When some states, in a brief period on, I think it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, when a lower court had said this, the SNAP funding had to be released, but the Supreme Court via Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson had not blocked that order yet, a bunch of states sent out money on cards. And so they were all, if you look at social media, for example, or even, you know, local news organizations, you'll see a lot of examples of people celebrating, finally, my EBT card has money on it. Well, what did the administration do? I think it was late Saturday night.
They told the
states to take the money back, which I'm not even sure is, well, legal or logistically
feasible. States had to go to court, and it was everything delayed people getting.
Yes. And then so they tried to block the states. They tried to force the states to claw back the money. And then even more peculiar, cruel, I don't know what the right adjective is, when there were retailers who said, we're going to try to help out customers who are normally SNAP recipients who have had this lapse in funding. We're going to give them a discount on their groceries. And there are a number of grocery stores around the country that decided to do this, just like there were food banks that were getting more donations and distributing more food. You know, there were a lot of community action to try to help people who were suffering during all of this. The administration sent out a letter to all retailers that participate in the SNAP program and said, you better not give people a discount. If you do, we're going to take away your ability to participate in this program. That was basically what they said. It's prohibited. And the way that they were doing it was through this rule that is supposed to prevent discrimination against SNAP recipients. But in this case, they're saying you can't offer them kindness either.
This feels like a Stephen Miller project. It's like he said, let me take care of this.
I'm telling you, it's like, how did they even think to do this? Especially when the government was ostensibly shut down. They've somehow found the resources to like comb through the rule book to figure out how they could punish private businesses who were trying to offer kindness just so that they could maximize suffering and therefore bring Democrats to heel. That was the argument. Now, what's confusing about all of this is that it seemed like Democrats were winning, that people were either experiencing themselves or seeing with their eyes examples of how the administration was trying to maximize suffering. They probably didn't know about this email that went out to grocery stores. Most people didn't. I happen to because I follow this stuff. You know, they probably saw the headlines about the request to the Supreme Court, multiple requests to that Supreme Court, rather, saying, please don't force us to distribute the money. So it was like pretty transparent who to blame for this suffering that was resulting from the shutdown. And if you look at the polling reflected that people were primarily blaming Republicans and Trump.
Now, where was the Supreme Court at this point? Because it was got up to the Supreme Court, but they kicked it back twice, right?
Yes. Well, it's a little bit complicated, but basically Ketanji Brown Jackson is in charge of the First Circuit Court.
Yeah.
And so rather than saying, I'm going to have the whole court vote on this, I'm going to kick it back to the lower courts themselves and say, give us like a meatier decision. Because the original decision was like, you got to send the money out and without a lot of explanation. So it was like, have a more robust decision. We will review it. And the lower courts did that, sent it back to her. And the administration was like, you got to review that and decide whether we have to send the money out. And it's a little bit silly because, as we've been discussing, and will hopefully be the case by the time this podcast goes out into the world, the government is about to reopen. And so, like, why are they still fighting over whether they have to release SNAP funds while the government is shut down, if the whole thing is going to be moved
now.
Yeah, but I think they're still going to try to seek a decision on this because there are questions about presidential powers that are implicit in all of this. It's not just about the food stamp program.
Oh, presidential powers is a big subject of this president.
Yep.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Catherine Rampell. So we got a new sponsor, Graza, my olive oil of choice. You know, I love to cook for me and Franny and for my kids and grandchildren, for friends. And I love cooking with olive oil. And Graza is a delicious, easy-to-use, extra virgin olive oil at an affordable, everyday price. Graza is always fresh. They pick, press, and bottle all their olives in the same season. You can see the harvest date on every bottle. I never thought about that before, but it's comforting. Graza has two types of extra virgin olive oils to stock your kitchen. There's Sizzle, that's their everyday cooking oil, perfect for roasting, sauteing, and, well, anything you cook. And they also have Drizzle, a flavorful finishing oil that's great for dipping bread and whipping up a salad dressing. That's Sizzle and Drizzle, the name of the two Graza brothers. Speaking of family, my family loves my marinara sauce. It's simple. I slowly saute garlic and onions in Graza's Sizzle oil. Put in the canned tomatoes, a bay leaf, and basil, and cook slowly for hours. Perfect for pasta, eggplant parmesan, lasagna. Of course, olive oil is the healthiest fat that I add to my meals. I'd highly recommend Graza for any home chef who likes to cook. So head to graza.co and use Franken to get 10% off and get to cooking your next chef quality meal. That's graza.co and use promo code Franken today for 10% off your first order. Graza, the best olive oil in my kitchen. We are back with Catherine Rampell. You write about economics. I want to get your take on some aspects of the economy. Americans are not happy. They think the cost of living is going up too fast. Trump says that's a lie. Can we play that clip, Peter?
It was a con job. Affordability, they call it, was a con job by the Democrats. The Democrats are good at a few things, cheating on elections and conning people with facts that aren't true. They said, oh, I don't want to talk about affordability. The reason I don't want to talk about affordability is because everybody knows that it's far less expensive under Trump than it was under sleepy Joe Biden.
Here she is, sir.
And the prices are way down.
It's far less expensive.
No, none of that is true.
None of that's true. And
yeah.
Do MAGA people hear that? I mean, they must have played it once on Fox or something like that. I mean, and then said, "Oh, let's stop playing that." But or maybe they never did. But I mean,
no, they've been playing. I oftentimes have the TV with the four boxes on. You know, uh-huh. So you can see MSNBC, CNBC, Fox, and CNN, or you know, some other mix of things. And so I've had the TV on mute, and I've been looking at the chyrons on Fox, and they've been covering Trump is attacking the affordability crisis, and he's going to get prices down. I haven't been listening so closely to their coverage, but they kind of want to have their cake and eat it too. Either there isn't an affordability crisis, and it's a con job or whatever, or there is one and Trump is tackling it. I don't know. It's somewhere in one of those two things, which seem somewhat at odds.
Well, they live in America, the MAGA people, and they go to the grocery store and they have to hear that and go, that's not right. Things aren't cheaper now. What?
Well, it probably helps that, again, with the government shutdown, lots of functions aren't occurring, including data releases. So we have been flying blind a little bit. We haven't gotten the recent jobs report. We haven't gotten the most recent inflation data, the report that the Federal Reserve cares more about.
I'm not talking about people who follow inflation data.
You're talking about people going to the grocery store. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And Trump, you know, again, sometimes will recognize that there's a problem and sometimes will deny that there's a problem. I saw that he gave an interview, I want to say yesterday, where he said, we're going to help with coffee prices by reducing tariffs on coffee. Yeah, whoever was the bonehead who decided to raise tariffs on coffee from Brazil and Colombia and Vietnam, that guy definitely doesn't deserve to be president. But it was Trump, right?
Well, on Brazil, you know, Brazil is prosecuting his friend.
His buddy.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's like, I'm going to be the hero and reduce tariffs on coffee. Coffee prices have gone way up, partly because of tariffs, partly because of drought and some other, you know, geopolitical things. So he's like, he wants praise. It's again, the arsonist wants praise for his firefighting skills. He's the one who put the tariffs on coffee. Now he wants to be praised for maybe reducing tariffs on coffee. I don't know that he's actually done it yet. Maybe that'll happen again by the time this podcast goes out into the world, but
Maybe the Supreme Court. We'll get to that in a bit. Your piece on that in the Bulwark.
He also said he's going to get gas prices down to $2 a gallon. Here's a little quiz for you. When was the last time gas was $2 a gallon?
Probably during the pandemic.
Yes. Yeah, it was like spring 2020. You know why gas was $2 a gallon?
Because no one was using gas. I mean,
yes, because there was like a giant global recession.
Yeah,
you know,
yes.
Like, I guess that's one way to get gas prices down is if you completely destroy demand.
When the pandemic ended during Biden and people started using gas again and industry was going and using gas and diesel, the price of gas went up. And Trump kept saying, when I was president, it was $2. It was less than $2 when I was president.
Yeah, but it was less than $2 because we were in a global economic crisis.
Yes, exactly.
He just doesn't understand he doesn't understand really anything about the economy. He doesn't understand why gas prices were low at various points and whether that's actually a good thing.
He thinks tariffs are good for the economy, which is we'll talk about that in a bit. I want to Steve Rattner was on Morning Joe, and he went over some statistics. Trump is at a 37% approval rating for his handling the economy. I don't know why that makes me laugh.
You mean because he partly won on his grand economic agenda and how he was going to reduce inflation and make the economy great again? Yeah, it is a little bit funny. It would be funnier if we weren't having to deal with the consequences ourselves. But yes, it is a little bit funny.
It's funny. First-time homebuyers are now on average 40 years old.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Bill Pulte, director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, or the FHFA, has proposed a 50-year mortgage. And so if the average person who gets a mortgage is 40 years old, that means they'll be 90
when they pay off
their mortgage.
Or if they try to sell it before then, presumably, because I would imagine they're not. Well, who knows? Maybe that'll be everybody's forever home. But they'll find out that when they sell it, they have a lot less equity is part of the issue. Like, I don't think the real scary scenario is that people are going to hold it until 90. I think the issue is people don't realize that if they get a 50-year mortgage, let's say, they're going to be paying primarily interest for a very long time. They will have paid down very little of the principal, which comes out to meaning they're not going to have that much equity in the home that they're buying. They'll have a slightly smaller monthly payment, which I guess is good, but they lose a lot of the benefits of the investment in home ownership. So it's not really clear who this helps. You know, we already have interest-only mortgages that this is not functionally would not be that different from.
What do you mean by interest-only mortgages?
There are non-amortizing loans. So you can get them and you pay only interest. And when you sell the house, you have not paid, you know, you have no equity in the house, effectively. You have not paid. This exists as a loan. Actually, I looked at it when I was a first-time home buyer at the spring chicken young age of 38. And I would say that interest rates were high at the time, so which is why I was looking at it, but ultimately did not decide to do it. But it makes sense, potentially, if you think interest rates are about to fall.
Okay. One of the statistics is the unemployment rate is at 4.2% overall, which is not so bad at all.
Again, that's old data because we haven't had the most recent data because the government shut down, but yes.
And 9.2% for ages 20 to 24, which in that data doesn't include people in college. Mm-hmm. These are people looking for a job.
Okay.
Is this a recession for young people, or are we... you wrote in your tariff piece that we're in danger of stagflation.
Yes. Whether or not we are in a recession will ultimately be determined by this official group of economists, and they haven't ruled yet. And they usually wait a long time to like make a call for like last year a recession began in such and such a month. So.
It has to be a number of months, right? For
no.
economic...
No, no. If you look at the pandemic recession, so at the beginning of COVID, that was really brief. That was like maybe 2 months. I'm trying to remember. I think it's, I don't have the dates in front of me, but I think it like started in March or April and was done within 2 months officially. Because it's about when the economy shrinks and when the economy starts growing again. Okay. And the economy, when it reopened, it started growing again really quickly, you know, very soon after stuff started reopening. So, you know, official recession calls are made by this one group. They haven't ruled yet. Are specific demographics really suffering? Yeah, I think that there are particular demographics that are struggling. And that's because of a number of reasons. And it's not all about Trump. Normally, I would say presidents don't have that much influence over the economy. This one is maybe an exception because he's done so many boneheaded things to make the economy worse, including the tariffs. The fact that young people, particularly those right out of college or maybe struggling to get jobs, could also be related to AI, frankly, that a lot of like entry-level job type tasks are being automated. So, you know, we don't know exactly yet, but I think there are other factors.
I want to talk to you about AI a little later, but let's talk about SCOTUS arguments on tariffs. You wrote the piece in Bulwark, and you're saying that basically this is hurting businesses. I think you called it pointless tariff minimizing bullshit, as you call it, which is
term of art.
These people, these businesses that had to have to import would have to game when they imported because of Trump changing the tariffs.
Yeah, because he changes them from day to day or minute to minute. So if you are a company that is, let's say you're a retailer or a wholesaler, and you have to get a lot of your products from abroad, from day to day, the effective tariff rates that you pay could be wildly different. There was one business that I spoke with, for example, called Balsam Hill. They make fancy artificial
Christmas trees.
Yes, yep, yeah. You know them? Okay, yep.
No. Yeah, I read your article.
Oh, okay. I'm a good Jewish girl, so I don't have a Christmas tree. So I was not as familiar. But apparently I'm told by friends of mine who are, you know, Christmas enthusiasts that this is like the Rolls Royce of Christmas trees that are sold. Anyway, so they import their Christmas trees from China. This is a business that they've looked into whether they could move manufacturing to the US, and it is just not feasible because these are pre-lit Christmas trees. So that means like they're very labor intensive. Somebody has to string the lights through the tree. And you could not do that in the United States because it just would not be like the price point that you would have to sell that at, given what it costs, you know, what American workers reasonably can demand because we're higher up in the value chain. Anyway, they couldn't move it here. So they're importing from China, and the tariff rates on China are all over the place from the start of this year.
What's the highest it's been, and
like well over 100%. I think at one point it was like 150%. I don't remember. And you know what has been announced versus what has actually been implemented are also two different things.
So this manufacturer that you talked about would have to change his orders and...
Yeah, he was telling me, he's like, we're canceling and uncanceling and scheduling and rescheduling.
And this, that means he can't hire as many people?
Yeah, he's spending all of his time figuring out how to keep the business viable given these tariffs because their costs vary tremendously from day to day. He said that last year they paid about $1 million in tariff revenue or, you know, tariff bills.
Right.
This year they're going to pay about $15 million. And if they had gotten unlucky and they had shipped on the wrong dates, mm-hmm. their bill would have been $117 million, right? Which is many multiples of their profits. So that's huge. Last year was $1 million. This year, they could have paid a bill of $117 million. And he's one company. And, you know, Christmas trees are a weird business. They do their own, you know, it's like they're mm-hmm. not. You
but can't it sounds generalize. Very successful.
Yeah, you can't generalize to all businesses. But a lot of businesses have dealt with these same annoying constraints. And so they're like frantically trying to figure out, do we have the ship come over now? Do we have to have the trucks like circle the warehouse a few times? He referred to it as the hokey pokey.
Okay, and then multiply this by all these businesses.
Right, exactly. So there are a lot of businesses who they have to pay higher tariffs. They waste a lot of time figuring out how to optimize so they can minimize how much they're paying in tariffs. And there's so much uncertainty that they might just like be paralyzed altogether and say, you know what, we're not going to invest. We're not going to hire. Maybe we'll have layoffs because we don't know what our costs will be going forward. So if you remove all of those layers of like just like weights that are weighing on these businesses, yeah, that would be quite helpful. Not to mention the fact that...
To the economy,
yeah.
For God's sake. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Catherine Rampell.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
I love to sleep. I love to get a good 7 to 9 hours every night. And I found out what really helps is a good bed with good sheets and a good pillow. And there's enough in the world to keep you up at night. Your bedding shouldn't be one of them. That's why I'd like to tell you about Ghost Bed. Ghost Bed is a family-run company focused on quality and comfort and cooling, all in an effort to help people like you and me sleep better. Their mattresses are made from premium materials to help regulate temperature throughout the night so that you don't wake up overheated. And they're built to last, backed by a 20 to 25 year warranty. You also get a 101 night sleep trial to make sure that it's the right fit for you. And here's the best part. Ghost Bed mattresses cost up to 50% less than comparable brands. So you're getting real quality at a fair price. I've gotten to check out their great bedding. The Ghost sheets are made of Supima cotton with tensile fibers, specially designed to keep you cool at night while also prioritizing durability and resisting allergens and bacteria growth. The Ghost Pillow is a memory foam pillow that promotes cooling. Right now, during Ghost Bed's fall sale, you can get 25% off site-wide for a limited time. Just go to ghostbed.com/franken and use promo code franken at checkout. That's ghostbed.com/franken, promo code franken. Upgrade your sleep with Ghost Bed, the makers of the coolest beds in the world. And we are back with Catherine Rampell. Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court.
Sure.
So Neil Katyal, he represented the plaintiffs, right? Mm-hmm. He opened with three words, tariffs are taxes, which they are. And the justices, most of them anyway, agreed, right?
Well, it sounded that way from their questions. I would say that you never know, right? Like sometimes what they say in the oral argument is different from how they ultimately come down. But from the questions that they asked, they sounded somewhere between skeptical and outright hostile to the government's arguments.
Okay. And the Solicitor General, who's arguing for the White House, said that under the International Emergency Powers Act, the president can impose tariffs in an emergency, except that International Emergency Powers Act doesn't mention tariffs.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of issues here.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the justices point that out, or was that?
Yeah. This is this is the core part of this case, which is, can the president just levy tariffs whenever he wants to?
And that's Congress is supposed to levy tariffs, right?
Yeah, there's a thing called the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It says that Congress has power of the purse. They get to levy taxes.
Tariffs
are taxes.
Yep.
And so the question is, can the president do this whenever he decides there's a national emergency? And then also, what can count as a national emergency, right? So there are sort of multiple questions here. The main one is about the tariffs. The other is about the national emergency piece of this. And is it a national emergency if we have a trade deficit? Trump says yes. Is it a national emergency if, I don't know, people in Brazil are being mean to Trump's good friend, Bolsonaro? Trump says yes. Is it a national emergency if the premier of Ontario decides to have a TV ad that accurately quotes Ronald Reagan?
Right.
Trump says yes. That was why he said he cut off the tariff negotiations with Canada that are about these national emergency tariffs because of the Ronald Reagan ad. So there is this question of, like, can the president effectively decide whenever he wants that he's going to slap tariffs on something because his feelings are hurt, essentially. And I'm not a lawyer. You know, I do more of the econ side of things. But from my discussions with legal experts, and particularly those who are like deep into the Federalist Society greater universe, the argument is essentially this is like a big separation of powers question. And even though the Supreme Court has, in many other cases, been willing to expand presidential power, you know, this unitary executive stuff, in this particular case, they seem much more inclined, even before we heard their oral arguments, to say, no, Trump, you cannot do this. This is supposed to be the purview of Congress, particularly since the law we're talking about, IEPA, does not delegate away that authority.
Okay, so when will they decide this? We don't know.
We don't know.
Should do it soon, I hope.
Yeah, we don't know. We know that the administration had asked basically for the case to be fast-tracked.
And your Christmas tree company, should they decide the president doesn't have authority, will get money back.
Right, exactly. So not only will businesses and potentially the greater economy benefit from tariffs being lifted going forward because they won't have to worry about all of this bullshit, you know, and moving the ships and the trucks and the warehouses around, but also they will be rebated back all of the tariff money that they've already paid. So in the case of Christmas Tree Company, they've paid, or they're expecting to pay some $15 million this year. They're going to get $15 million back. Now, on what time frame, we don't know, and there will probably be some logistical difficulties in all of this. They don't have to be. When I've talked with trade experts, they've said, you know, like customs and border protection have been able to rebate money back pretty much automatically before. I'm sure that they'll drag their feet, but it doesn't really matter. It's like once companies know that that money is coming back, they can spend. Markets are going to reflect that. Presumably, people are going to feel more flush. I mean, I think you're already seeing this, to be fair, in markets. I think that's part of the reason why stock markets have been relatively strong, because there is an assumption that the Supreme Court is going to strike down these tariffs.
Well, they've been strong because of the AI, too. I mean,
that's true also, yes.
I mean, I don't know if there's an AI bubble or not. Should I buy or sell NVIDIA?
I don't know. I'm the wrong person to ask.
Okay.
But I'm happy to talk about AI and whether there's a bubble. But
What is AI going to? I mean, people are losing jobs in UPS and Amazon and other places. And is AI going to create or destroy more jobs?
Yes.
In the future? Yes.
Both. I mean, every time there's a major disruptive technology, some people lose their jobs and some people get jobs. And it is often not the same people, right? Like, we saw this during the Industrial Revolution. There were plenty of artisanal guild type people who were replaced by machines. The horse and buggy whip people were replaced by automobiles.
How hard would it be to replace my job here when I'm doing with AI?
I don't know.
Are there AI podcasts?
There are AI songs, like composing programs. I don't know about podcasts. Probably it could be done. I don't know. There's probably the service already exists somewhere. You know, the hope is that like what you are doing is uniquely human and could not be and Al Franken could not be replicated by large language model. But maybe.
Thank you.
I don't know. You could go into ChatGPT and say like, can you write an Al Franken joke for me and see what it says. See how well it does. But it will replace a lot of creative jobs. You know, most of the other big technological innovations, disruptions that come to mind, you know, the people replaced by the automated loom or the automated thresher or the automobile, et cetera. I think we tend to think of those as more physical labor type jobs and not so much creative type jobs, you know, white collar particular positions. Lots of factory workers have been replaced by robots. So I think this will be disruptive to a different class of people than we've seen in the past. And I don't know how that's going to play out.
Nope.
You know, will people still want columnists and journalists? I don't know. Whenever there are these disruptions, there are new jobs created too, because there are new jobs that spring up that are complementary to the new technology. And then there are jobs that are just like, they're uniquely human and they're really hard to replace. So you just have to hope that you can develop skills in one of those areas.
Okay. Well, we have little time left. I ask you a political question. Gavin Newsom he's in Brazil. He's running. He was just in Texas.
Yeah.
So is presidential politics are beginning already?
Oh, I assume that all these guys have been running for president since they were about 14. So it is interesting, though, that he went to Texas, because presumably Texas is not in play.
Right.
For the Democrats in 2028.
Well, but Texas have Democrats. They have delegates.
They have delegates. That's true.
Right. So you have to get the nomination. And
That's true.
And it's a big state.
And there is a big showdown right now over gerrymandering and redistricting that effectively began with Texas and California.
Oh, that makes sense. That's why I visited.
So I assume that's part of it as well.
Well, thanks, Catherine. Good seeing you again.
Likewise. Come back on my show.
Congratulations. We will. I will. I'm a we.
You're a we, the royal we.
Yeah.
You and your AI helpers.
Yeah. AI, when you if you put it on a computer, it looks like Al.
That's true.
It does. Well, thanks again. Congratulations on your little girl.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.